Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What kind of system might solve the health problems of the greatest number of Americans? And what are the chances that such a plan will actually be enacted? President Obama spoke of health care access as a national priority during the 2008 campaign. But now some critics say the economic crisis is pushing the need for health reform to the back burner. Assuming it does come to the forefront, what would a really effective overhaul even look like? Luke Mitchell is here to talk about what he has learned. He's senior editor for Harper's Magazine, which just published his cover story, Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. Luke, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with this. We are currently spending an enormous amount on healthcare, and the amount is increasing every single year. Can you give us some idea of just how much that is?
That's right. We spend about $2 trillion on healthcare every year, and that's going to continue to grow, possibly even into a hockey stick-shaped curve. It's just exploding because of the cost of new technology, the cost of adding more people to the system. And right now that amounts to about $7,000 per person, which is more than any other nation.
And compared to every other nation, in terms of quantifiable results, how good is the healthcare we get?
Well, it's not the worst healthcare system in the world, but considering that it's the most expensive healthcare system in the world, it's shockingly mediocre. We lag behind other nations in life expectancy, in early detection of life-threatening illnesses, in infant mortality, unbelievably. We're not really getting a bargain for the money we're spending.
The point that you made earlier about technology is an interesting one, because I think a lot of people think about, you know, growing demand and the baby boomers getting older. But part of this is simply that we keep inventing things that we can't really pay for.
Well, it's sort of good news, bad news, right?
Yeah.
Nobody doesn't want the new technology that's going to add a few years to their lives or take some pain away or you know, for example, pancreatic cancer was instantly understood to be death just a few years ago. And now more and more people are having longer and longer lives because of these treatments. But they are also quite expensive and, in fact, make up a huge proportion of the growth and cost. And what that means is two things. One, there are things that are possible now that we still can't do because we can't afford it. But it also means that we're making choices between those and other less expensive treatments that people might need in their day-to-day lives. So it's bringing to the forefront of our decision-making process something that we might have been able to avoid before, which is the question of rationing. How do we make decisions about who gets what?
And we're essentially already rationing.
That's right. Everybody rations. And in fact, you could start with the very process of visiting your doctor, and you say to the doctor, what should I do? And the doctor is going to make a decision about that based on what's best for your health, but also what you can afford, what's available to you in your community, and on and on and on. Every society has set up some sort of rationing system. What we forget is that the rationing system we seem to prefer in the United States is the marketplace. That is to say, we ration based on who can afford what treatment. And people have a lot of associations with that form of rationing that they think are positive because they associate that with so-called freedom. But of course, if you can't afford a treatment, that you're not free to get it.
Yeah, we love to talk about the free market, and we like to think that we have choices. But maybe you can talk for a minute about how the current system already really diverges from free market economic principles.
Well, it does in so many ways. It's funny. When I was reporting this piece for Harper's, I kept coming across politicians and political experts who would talk about socialized medicine. They would say, well, maybe this is a good system, but Americans don't like socialized medicine. But it turns out two things are not true about that claim. One, pretty much every medical system on Earth is socialized. That is to say, the government has a strong hand in determining who pays for what. And two, Americans don't mind that. An amazing poll shows that a plurality of Americans, that is to say, more Americans than any other group, answered this question, which form of medical system would you prefer, by saying they would prefer a system of, quote, socialized medicine. That is to say, a plurality of Americans prefer socialized medicine over all of the other choices in front of them, which boggled my mind because that's not something you really hear very often in the media. But it turns out that most people recognize that the system is complex and driven by factors other than the market or even your best interests.
It is pretty amazing, though, that you can even use the term socialized medicine, which seems, at least for American politicians on both the left and the right, like a third rail.
That's right. And I think part of this is, you know, things change a lot slower in Washington than they do elsewhere. So there's like an almost comical hangover from Cold War concerns about, you know, the Soviet threat and the Red Scare, right? You know, like you can picture, you know, a 68-year-old congressman thinking, well, my constituents aren't going to put up with that sort of thing because they, you know, they saw Red Dawn once on cable TV or something. But I think there's also a much more, well, I hate to use the word sophisticated because I think it's still not a correct feeling, but a feeling that's more rooted in the American sensibility that Americans just don't like anything that's going to prevent them from doing what they want, and they do associate that with socialism. But all of these complaints or concerns are not based on any kind of rational analysis of what's actually on the table. I mean, you may not want government intervention in your health care, and that's fine. That's a coherent ideological position, but no one is offering you that alternative right now. Every alternative you have involves the government making decisions about how you get treated. For example, the alternative we're looking at right now this year when we talk about health care reform probably is going to require people to buy insurance from private companies. Now, the requirement is a government requirement, but the insurance is private insurance. Is that socialized medicine?
Well, the insurance companies obviously love this opportunity because they get to spread out the risk pool and they get to bring more people on. Is that the best way to do it, to keep it private but require it for everyone?
I don't think so. And most people don't think so who think about this a lot. This is sort of a stopgap measure. Even Barack Obama, who's very smart on these issues, actually, has said that my preferred solution, single payer, which we can talk about in a minute, is the best way to go, but that we can't go that way because there's so many institutional obstacles to achieving it, that end.
Well, it's interesting. He said that long before he was president or even senator.
That's right. And now
he doesn't say that so much.
No, well, he's never quite said that single payer is not the best way to go. What he said is that it's not a way that we can go, even though pretty much every other wealthy Western nation has gone this way with great success. Well, more or less great success, because running the healthcare system for any country is always going to be difficult, but certainly with greater success in terms of the basic metrics of healthy society than we have seen in the United States.
Luke Mitchell is my guest. He's senior editor for Harper's Magazine. His work is the cover story this month. It's called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. Luke, this is not in the piece, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but have any of those other countries that are successful with a single-payer sort of government-administered system, have any of them converted from anything like this Byzantine system we have of some public health care and a lot of private insurance?
Well, I don't want to say this with any sense of authority, but not that I know of. And I will say that logically it would be very difficult to come up with an example because our system is unprecedented. It's larger than any other system. It's dealing with technology that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago. So I'm not unsympathetic to people who say that we have unique circumstances that can't be dealt with by the methods of other nations. But the people who say that have an affirmative obligation to come up with their own best solution. And I haven't heard anyone say anything that made as much sense as single payer.
How much healthcare spending right now goes to insurance administration?
Ah, now that is a number that should be at my fingertips. I seem to remember somewhere that it was something like 40% of healthcare costs go to administrative overhead. Though, in fairness to reality, any number you hear on that is going to have a lot of made-up stuff in it because what really is administration as opposed to medical decision-making. But it's a huge proportion by any count.
If we were to somehow eliminate the insurance companies, would there be a significant blow to our economy from the, I think you listed, 500,000 jobs that would be lost?
Well, that's right. 500,000 people work for the health insurance industry. Now, not all of those people would be out of work. And to the degree that anyone believes in market solutions, the idea that we need to maintain an industry that's inefficient in order to keep people at work is not entirely coherent. And that said, a lot of the people in the insurance industry would find work dealing with the problems that we would still confront in terms of getting doctors paid, getting hospitals administered, and so on. So put it this way, I don't think the health insurance industry is our best bet at a new works project administration. I think we could serve ill people better with other approaches.
We know that in some cases, Medicare and particularly Medicaid pays less to doctors than some private health plans. Would medical professionals earn less under a system that was completely government administered?
I think I want to reject the premise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Only because, one, my understanding of the current healthcare system is that it's entirely government administered. That is to say, it's deeply, deeply regulated. Medical organizations have huge influence via, for example, AMA lobbying. And so the changes we're talking about have to do with who's making profits. It doesn't really affect who's making decisions in the private sector versus in the government sector as much as people want to think it does. That all said, the devil is certainly in the details. A government single-payer plan could pay doctors less, or could pay them more. That's a specific battle that would have to take place.
Mm-hmm. So, how very different would things look if tomorrow somehow you were automatically able to flip a switch and put us on a single payer system?
Well, there would be some good stuff that would happen right off the bat. For example, 50 million people who do not have insurance in the United States right now would have insurance. Now, that sounds like just the first part of a list, but to my mind, the argument could begin and end with that. The fact that the children have nowhere to turn when they're ill in this country is despicable. And but there's actually a lot more good things that would happen. For example, insurance companies now have no motivation to worry about your health after you turn 65 because you'll be out of the private insurance system and into the Medicare system and not their problem. That would change immediately, and therefore we would set up our systems such that they would treat you better for the long haul. You wouldn't have to worry about pre-existing conditions because there's no such thing as a pre-existing condition in a single-payer system because there's only one payer, and therefore you're never moving around, and you're in it as soon as you're born because you're an American citizen. People who were worried about quitting their job because they would lose their benefits would not have to worry about that, which would mean we'd see a huge mobility of labor in this country, which would be very healthy, especially in these hard times. Industries like the automotive industry that are under a huge burden of healthcare costs themselves because of the benefit system would see a light at the end of that particular tunnel. Those, obviously, they have current obligations they would still have to deal with, but it would be a huge burden off of them. It would make their capital more mobile. And on and on and on. It's basically freeing Americans and American business from one of the greatest financial burdens they have and creating, by the way, as an aside, a far more egalitarian system for our country.
Luke Mitchell is with us. He's senior editor for Harper's Magazine. We're talking about his article in the February 2009 issue of Harper's. It's called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior editor for Harper's Magazine, Luke Mitchell. His article in the February 2009 issue is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or drop an email to think@kera.org. Let us speak to Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. I wanted to echo the point about our manufacturers. GM's workers are working for within $2 an hour of any Toyota or Honda or anybody else in this country. And the 9 of the top 10 plants were GM, Chrysler, and Ford plants. So we're the most productive. All that extra cost is all the legacy costs for their health care. I'm a very small employer, and it's hard for me to keep people, and a lot of them would just soon rather have cash than even bother with the Social Security thing. And if healthcare were somehow tied to that, I think they'd be much more eager to make sure those, you know, monies were put in and they were accounted for. I could see national healthcare being a lot of buy-in from a lot of, you know, people that have been under the radar. And there's really not much benefit for them to get into it as it is.
Thomas, thanks for your call.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a great point that Thomas makes. The burden that the auto manufacturers are under from these legacy costs is just unbelievable. And I think, in fact, Obama had made a point a couple of years ago where he said that they could have a grand bargain where there would be some form of universal health care. And that would help the automotive manufacturers get out from under some of this burden. And that's the kind of bargain that can only be struck by the federal government because they do have serious obligations to their retired workers. But so far, most of the executives at the automotive manufacturers aren't coming out for single payer in any kind of significant way, which is shocking to me. But I think it's evidence of a sort of culture that's against some of the best solutions, despite their own self-interest.
Any idea, Luke, what the percentage assessment would need to be in order to put something like this in place, assuming that you take all private health insurance out of the mix and then you just take money out of everybody's check every couple of weeks?
Yeah, there's two answers to that. The first one is I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is I don't think anyone can answer that question in any kind of specific way because there's so many decisions that we're going to have to make about our healthcare system outside of how we finance it, about what treatments we do think are most important or what treatments we do think people should be required to have access to. And in fact, there's a good argument that one reason that everyone is paying $7,000 a year for health care is that we're over-treating a lot of people. That is to say, there are some treatments that we are giving people that may not be in their best interest, but because of the way the system is currently incentivized, they're being given them those treatments anyway.
To their detriment, you found, in many cases.
One of the examples I came across in from my Harper story was PSA testing. That's to say testing for prostate cancer. Now, this is somewhat controversial, but there's a good argument to be made that if you're young, you should not be tested for prostate cancer because early onset prostate cancer is actually far less damaging than the cure for early onset prostate cancer. So if you get the test and find some evidence, then you'll, of course, be obligated to go through treatment, and that treatment could cause you much less harm than simply waiting for stronger evidence of the cancer to make itself apparent. In fact, all men, if they live long enough, will get prostate cancer. So the question is, what do you do about it and when? And that's just one example. And these are questions that doctors are going to have to deal with as best they can. They're not really financial questions. And I think one of the things we run into, in fact, is this conflation of the finance system of healthcare and the actual healthcare system of healthcare. So, for example, single payer is a question about insurance. It's a question about national insurance. It's not a question about healthcare or national healthcare. It's not saying that doctors will work for the government. It's not saying that the government per se will decide who you get to see or where you get to go. It's saying that the most efficient way to get everyone health care is to have a single insurer, because the way insurance works most efficiently is to have the largest possible pool. It's just that simple. So that's a very long way of saying that those kinds of decisions about who gets treated are outside of the realm of single payer or not single payer.
An email from Jonathan in Dallas says, in terms of perception rather than fact, do you think racism has played a role in the U.S. not having national health care, in that blacks and Hispanics are disproportionately poor and therefore disproportionately benefit, and this bothers white people? England was an essentially all-white country when the NHS was established.
I think that's a terrific observation. I wish I'd worked that into my piece. And, I mean, my understanding of the last half of the 20th century being the story of the Southern Strategy and the idea that we're going to create a politics in Washington based on coded racism rather than overt racism, I think clearly one of the big problems that proponents of a single-payer system have run up against is this sort of closeted racism. And, in fact, now that I think about it, it seems to me that socialism has always been sort of a code word for we're going to give money to people who aren't the same color as you, and it's clearly been highly detrimental to the movement.
But in defense of people who oppose this, is this in fact any better for those who currently have access to insurance and to health care? In other words, is there an incentive other than sort of altruism and understanding that public health is good for the entire society? Do people who have insurance now really benefit if we switch the system?
It depends on what kind of insurance you have. Mm-hmm. At Harper's, we have terrific insurance, but it's not as good as it could be. Other people have insurance that they think is good, and we don't hear about this very much, but it turns out it's actually terrible when push comes to shove. And in fact, there are things that we don't know about in terms of individual peril. For example, You have solid gold benefits. Everything's going great. You have some condition. It turns out it was a pre-existing condition, and it turns out those great benefits that you never wanted to give up for some pig in a poke like a single-payer system were worthless. I think it's very difficult to make these comparisons except in the specific, but people who love their insurance often love it in the abstract and not so much in the specific.
Luke Mitchell is my guest. His article in Harper's is called Sick in the Head. Let's go next to Susan in Fort Worth. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Gosh, this is a big subject for me. I hate the socialist thing that's always stuck on it. This was Nixon's deal back with Kaiser Permanente, started in California. But and I think it's wonderful that our employees in Congress, have taken care of themselves. But I keep talking about, and I never hear it, and can't seem to get any response, is a private insurance company that is regulated by the government, and that would be a single payer. But non-profit rather than these all-for-profit system that we've had since Nixon.
I think that's a terrific idea. My only caveat is once you have a nonprofit government-sanctioned institution, the difference between that being private and public is one that you could sort of debate like angels on the head of a pin. But yes, any kind of single payer system that we can get going that's nonprofit would generate the kind of benefits we've been talking about this hour.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Louisville and speak to Brett. Hey, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great and timely topic. I just had one quick question. I heard you say earlier that there's about 500,000 people employed through the healthcare or through the insurance system. I'm wondering how many people aren't employed because of the healthcare we have. I own a small business, and it's like paying rent. You have to figure that as a fixed cost when you have an insurance.
That's right.
And it's something I have to consider whenever I consider hiring an employee. So I'm very curious about your thought on that and how it affects us in the global economy.
Well, Brett, I have a question for you, which is that my understanding is that the cost of an employee is something like double their salary. Is that right? That is to say, to you as an employer.
I work in a skilled labor, so no.
But
very expensive. It runs, you know, especially if you want to be competitive with other skilled employers, you're paying out of pocket anywhere from, depending on age and health, you know, $800 to $1,200 a month.
Right, right.
It can be very expensive.
And it's also, of course, incredibly regressive because the insurance is the same no matter what kind of employee you have, but it becomes a much smaller proportion of the cost of hiring, a very high dollar employee. So it hurts working people the most.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from GK who says, we often hear that we have one of the highest healthcare costs in the world because we have no prevention built into our system, unlike European countries that will cover regular checkups. What could be done to build prevention into the system?
Well, that goes to what we were talking about a little while ago about incentives, the financial incentives. That is to say, if you have insurance companies competing with each other to avoid unhealthy patients, you can create pools where there are the people who will never get sick and therefore cost you nothing and therefore are the most desirable customers, and the people who probably will get sick and therefore will cost you something and therefore are undesirable customers. And as long as those two pools exist, the incentives for preventative medicine will be very perverse. When you have a single payer, what happens is you want to keep every individual within the system as healthy as possible, and it becomes financially sensible to start thinking about how to treat them for the long haul. Therefore, smoking cessation, for example, I was a smoker for 17 years and had a terrible time quitting, but it's clearly going to add many years to my life and therefore also save some insurers somewhere a lot of money. Most insurers these days aren't that excited about smoking cessation because it's a problem that happens after you get into the Medicare system. Whereas if you had a single-payer system and therefore an obligation to someone over the course of their entire life, you would be much more willing to fund that sort of thing. Same with eating problems, same with gym incentives. These are all things that insurers do now, but they would have a much greater incentive to do under a single-payer system.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I want to talk for a minute about this idea of compelling health insurance for children or for everyone. Of course, throughout the campaign, Mr. Obama said that he was interested at least in ensuring that every child in America had insurance. Then initially, although this was not a great decision, he picked Tom Daschle to run Health and Human Services, and Daschle was an advocate of universal coverage. Is that, do you think, an indication of the president's willingness to expand his own plans?
I think it is. He seems to be a pragmatist who basically thinks about what can be done, not what should be done. And maybe that's the smartest way to get through life in Washington. And certainly, there's a false conflict, I think, in Washington between single-payer advocates and advocates of iterative steps toward ensuring as many people as possible within the current system. And the idea that we can't advocate for both is preposterous. That is to say, we should expand SCHIP. We should have universal coverage for children. And anything that we can get that's going to get better treatment for more people is something that I think all people of goodwill can agree is a good step. At the same time, we should be fighting for a system that just makes a lot more sense. And I always think it's a failure of imagination to think that these sort of large-scale changes, these systemic changes that do upset a lot of people who profit from the current system, are somehow impossible. We've had massive systemic changes many times in the past, everything from the New Deal to the Interstate Highway Defense Act to the Emancipation Proclamation. I mean, we can do these things, but in the meantime, let's get children some insurance.
What do you do about the unemployed in a system of universal health care? It's one thing when people understand that the money to pay for this comes out of their checks every week, but there will always be a segment of society that is looking for work.
That is to say, how do you charge people for their...
I guess, do you assume part of their unemployment benefits for as long as they last? Their health care continues?
Well, these are decisions you can make in the moment. But if I was in charge of things, I would say if you're a citizen, you have insurance, period. It wouldn't be predicated on employment of any kind.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to James in Denton. Hey, James.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from the United Kingdom originally, and I've been working in the states of Arkansas and Texas. And one of the things that astonishes me when I talk to some people about so-called socialized medicine is that they have opposition to it, and they say such things as, well, I want to be able to choose my doctor. They don't have a doctor, and they probably haven't seen a doctor for 10 years or something because they can't afford to. And I even spoke to a gentleman who lost his business through lack of insurance, and he was still opposed to socialized medicine because of the, you know, very not the very same reason, but things like they treat a common cold before they treat a gunshot wound and these sort of things. And I'm just wondering where the guest thinks, where did they get this from? It's almost like saying, I know we're starving, but I'm glad there's no food on the table, because if there was, we wouldn't like the taste of it. And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call.
I think James gets to the central conundrum of America in the 21st century. Why do we believe so many crazy things? And again, I think you could make a rational ideological argument that I would disagree with against a single-payer system or quote-unquote socialized medicine. But it would be an argument comparing something that doesn't exist to another thing that doesn't exist. But I do think the earlier caller who talked about particularly in Arkansas, which I lived near for years, there is certainly some racism going on in these things. There's also an abstract sense that the government's not to be trusted, which in some cases is not entirely unfounded. There's a sense that whatever interactions they've had with figures of authority have been unpleasant for them, and therefore the most clearly authoritarian figure they can think of is the government, and therefore they don't want to have any part of it, and on and on and on. But these are all psychological, and it's unfortunate that the people in Washington who are supposed to know better are allowing these psychological issues to determine the actual reality for so many people.
Luke Mitchell is my guest. He is senior editor for Harper's Magazine. His new piece this month is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. You're welcome to join us by sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Luke Mitchell is my guest. We're talking about his piece in Harper's Magazine this month called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. I want to talk for just a minute about how well most of us tend to understand what we are paying for in a system where all the costs are essentially cloaked.
Sure. It's very mysterious to even begin to try to understand what your money is actually going to pay for. When I was working on the Harper story, I tried to get some sense of the financial fortunes of the insurance industry as a whole, and it's not something that they want to be very forthcoming about, even though some of these companies are public companies. And this, by the way, goes to this question of competition. Good luck trying to compare the price of treatments between one place and another, much less the price of non-insured or insured treatments. There's just a lot of obfuscation going on.
Do insurance companies, though, ultimately really set the cost in that they decide what they're going to compensate for and to what extent?
I don't think anything is that simple.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
I think insurance companies want to reduce medical losses, and medical losses are what they call payments for people who are sick. And that is to say, they have an incentive to pay as little as possible. However, sometimes, you know, hospitals have an incentive to charge as much as possible. But those incentives can sometimes be turned on their heads. A hospital may find that because of the way the cost structures have worked out for a particular patient that they want to charge as little as possible. An insurance company may find that in a given circumstance they actually want to spend a lot on a treatment in order to avoid malpractice issues, or because they actually think this treatment would be more effective than it should. The medical equipment manufacturers, Big Pharma, which we haven't talked about, is hugely influential, and they have a lot of incentives for raising prices and for lowering prices. And so it's a lot of people doing things that don't make sense from, you know, an economics 101 perspective of maximizing profits by getting as much money for your product as you can, but do make sense to them in the instance.
The whole second half of your piece, and I would just recommend people go find the article and read it because we won't really have much time to get to it. But you talk about this automation of a lot of healthcare. Maybe you can speak for just a minute about how this is starting to affect the industry and the way decisions are made about the fates of human beings.
Well, I feel like I'm a little out of my area expertise talking about the fate of human beings. But what the heck?
To talk about McKesson for a minute.
Yeah. And listeners, by the way, can read this story at www.harpers.org, and I hope they do, because there's a lot in it that obviously we won't be able to get to. One of those things is McKesson, which is the 18th largest corporation in the United States and the largest health care corporation of any kind in the United States. It's bigger than the largest insurance corporation, UnitedHealth. And their headquarters is in San Francisco, and I went to visit them last summer to see what they thought was going to happen. What was their vision of the future of healthcare in the United States? And their vision, which I saw at their Vision Center, was fascinating. Basically, their CEO, John Hammergren, wrote a book describing a vision of what he calls an integrated delivery network. And this integrated delivery network would be a real thing. That is to say, would have computers at the center, and you would be connected to those computers in various ways over the Internet. And those computers would gather as much information about your health as possible. And it would take that information, you know, your genetic data, your proteomic data based on protein. It would, you know, take blood samples and saliva samples and compare that information to people in your family, people in clusters around your house, people with similar histories, and come up with probably very smart ideas about how to treat you and extend your life and make you healthy and happy. But that integrated delivery network is going to be a huge, hugely powerful force. And it's not at all clear who's going to wield that force or to what end.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Weatherford and speak to Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, nice show today.
Thank you.
The question I have, there's a couple of them. One, do we think that managed care has really helped decrease the cost of health care, or has it just delayed health care to a lot of people and it's going to become more expensive later on? And if they went out of the system, this group that doesn't provide health care but just oversees licensed physicians, what would the cost savings be there? You also mentioned integrated health care, and where I was working, they came up with computerized client records. And it took another whole half FTE for the physician to enter data. I'll listen for my answer. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, no, these are all things that are going to just come up again and again and again in any healthcare system. For example, you know, people have been trying to get these electronic health records together for decades because it's just obviously a good idea. You want to have information about you be as accurate and portable as possible as you move from doctor to doctor and condition to condition. And you want you know, your pharmacist to know as much about you as possible, as well as your doctor and your specialist. And, you know, it's going to be hard to get this right. That's a technical problem, and it's not necessarily within the realm of finance. I do think that, as we've seen over the last century or so, that information systems, when deployed properly, do help a lot of people. I don't think there's any disputing that. Just as, you know, mass production systems are better at producing cars, information systems are better at distributing information. The question is, who controls those systems? And my dream is that under a single payer system, the people control it. I'm a good old fashioned Democrat, small D, and I think the best way to govern a society is to have all the people understand what the society is trying to do and have an opinion about how to get it done. But you know, that's still going to be messy.
Do you know in the other single payer countries what the appeals process is like for people who are told that a particular condition or treatment is simply not available to them under the system?
It varies considerably from mm-hmm. country to country, and you hear horror stories.
Those are the ones that seem to make the TV here.
Yeah, and you know, another magazine has an article by someone who was arguing that in New Zealand she would not have been able to get the treatment for her breast cancer that saved her life in the United States. But of course, a lot of people in the United States aren't able to get that treatment either because they have no insurance and it's an expensive treatment. So there's a question not only about choice, but who gets those choices. And all of a sudden, if choices becomes a good, that is to say, freedom becomes a good, well, then we'll see that there's a limit on that as well. And so ultimately, I think it's sort of a false opposition that well, in countries with a single-payer system, you'll be prevented from getting treatment that you would be free to get in the United States. In fact, if you're wealthy in those other countries, you could get that treatment, just as if you're wealthy in this country, you will always be able to get better treatment than if you're not.
Let's go next to Kirk in Dallas. Hello, Kirk.
Hi, great call. I'm going to give Mr. Mitchell an opportunity to talk about a topic he touched on a few minutes ago, Big Pharma. In my assertion, my humble opinion, we don't have a healthcare system in the U.S. We have a huge illness profit system that benefits Big Pharma as long as this current system that we have now remains unchanged. It's a huge business. So my question is, I mean, this conversation, what if this conversation weren't even necessary? What if just through quality nutrition and cleansing, which people have been doing in other cultures for centuries and enables them to remain healthy, what if people stayed healthy for the most part? And I don't argue that we need an improved healthcare system, but what if fewer people got sick? Who would stand to gain and who would stand to lose?
Well, that's exactly right. That's why I keep coming back to incentives. Obviously, under the current system, you know, it's a commonplace about growth, GDP growth. This is how we measure the health of a system. And therefore, if our gross domestic product is growing, our system is growing, and we're healthy. But in fact, that's not true. The joke you hear in economics classes all the time is like, well, if you include, you know, an increase in divorces, an increase in cancer treatment, an increase in automobile repair as good things, well, then it's good to have the economy growing because those all create GDP growth. But in fact, what you really want in a system is maximum health, which is not a market good at all, as your caller makes the very valid point. It's its own good, determined by its own criteria. And so, yes, to the degree that we remove profit from the system, you may introduce some inefficiencies, but you also introduce a lot of other quote-unquote efficiencies based on your other actual goals, which is not to get someone rich, which I don't think is necessarily any time a good society-wide goal. It's a good individual goal. But to get someone healthy, which is always a good society-wide goal. Sorry.
That's okay. Let's go next to Marion in Fort Worth. Hey, Marion.
Yes, I just had a comment similar to the last caller, in that it's a little off topic, but I pay pet insurance for my dog. My dog has to go and have a six-month checkup. It's very based on prevention, making sure the dog has the shots. And so I'm also a great proponent of personal responsibility in trying to maintain your health and, you know, decrease the need for utilizing the health system.
I think that's a terrific point. And, in fact, all of the people who really took healthcare reform seriously that I spoke to for my Harper's article came back again and again and again to this idea that the way you keep people healthy is to keep them out of hospitals. In fact, something like 20,000 people die every year in the United States because they don't have access to health care. But something like 30,000 people die every year in the United States because they were in a hospital and because they got an infection or there was some sort of malpractice and they died. And clearly, the best way to lower the cost of health care in the United States is to create a system of incentives for people to stay healthy. And none of those incentives exist under the current insurance regime.
59% of U.S. doctors now say they support socialized medicine in this country. Did that number surprise you?
It did. Mm-hmm. Doctors are generally considered to be very conservative and out for their own interests. And in fact, they are very conservative and they are out for their own interests. But they're more and more recognizing that a single-payer system would save them a huge amount of overhead. I think they recognize that also that they're going to be able to probably get a pretty good deal on malpractice insurance out of this, though that's a very specific thing that I'm not an expert on. But it'll definitely be part of the mix. And like the automobile manufacturers, I think they're recognizing that this approach would solve their problems, not introduce more problems. And I guess they're a little bit ahead of the automobile manufacturers in saying so publicly.
Ultimately, your assessment is that we are using numbers in this country to rationalize inequality. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's yes. And from my Harper's piece, I had thought I was just going to talk about single-payer and political story, but it became so clear to me that single-payer was such an obviously better approach, and I became so perplexed as to why people wouldn't pursue it as the superior approach from Barack Obama all the way on down, that I had to look further afield and begin to consider more esoteric theories about why people didn't want this approach. And I think there's been a sense throughout history, certainly in Western history, that if you can make something abstract, if you can turn it into a number, you can control it. And you can just think of Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, you know, the famous spread-eagled man in the center of a circle. And then think of how he was trying to turn his actual anatomy experiments into some higher form of data. And you can see this impulse. And it certainly informed every part of the Industrial Revolution. That is to say, we had so-called scientific management, where we would so-called rationalize a process by measuring every element of it, trying to come up with a consistent approach to dealing with those measures. And in the end, it turned out that actually did work pretty well. We made a lot of cars, not to pick on the automobile industry. And in fact, at McKesson, they talked about how they saw part of their mission as taking people, turning them into information, and putting them into a system where that information would be much more efficiently controlled and then spit back out into the real world. And that is an amazing vision, but it's got a lot of dark undertones.
Luke Mitchell is senior editor for Harper's Magazine. His cover story for the February issue is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. Luke, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.